Welcome to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast for April 2015. I'm your host, Don Cameron of Breskin & Parr LLP in Toronto, Canada. We hope you'll find this podcast informative, but it should not be taken as legal advice. The opinions expressed are solely those of the participants. On March 24th, the Supreme Court of the United States handed down their decision in B&B Hardware against Hargis Industries and made some new law on issue preclusion. They held that a finding that two trademarks were confusing, made by the TTAB during opposition proceedings, could preclude fighting that same issue again in a subsequent trademark infringement lawsuit. William Jay is a partner at Goodwin Procter LLP in Washington, D.C., and co-chairs their appellate litigation practice. He has extensive experience with litigation in the U.S. Supreme Court and the U.S. Courts of Appeals. He successfully argued at the Supreme Court on behalf of B&B Hardware in the B&B and Hargis case. I spoke with Willie from his office in Washington, D.C. Hello, Willie.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you. So tell me about the facts of the B&B Hardware and Hargis case.
Well, as Justice Alito said in his opinion for the Supreme Court, the full set of facts could fill a long and unhappy book, so I won't go into every nuance of the facts, but this is a dispute between two small companies that has been going on for the better part of two decades over the mark Sealtight, and one of them spells it S-E-A-L-T-I-G-H-T, that's my client, B&B, and the other spells it S-E-A-L-T-I-T-E, that's Hargis, and each of them uses it on or in connection with a fastener product that it makes. And B&B makes fasteners for the aerospace industry, like projects like the Mars rover, and Hargis makes fasteners for the metal building industry, construction fasteners. And B&B's mark is the senior mark. B&B has been using it longer. So the current lawsuit is a lawsuit by B&B against Hargis for infringing its rights in its registered mark. But there was a previous round of litigation between the same companies before the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board about whether Hargis would get to first cancel B&B's mark and second, as a result, register its own mark. And B&B prevailed in that round of litigation. And that really is the question that came to the Supreme Court, whether the answer to that litigation that the Trademark Board reached would be preclusive, you know, or binding on the district court hearing the infringement case.
And as far as sort of the end of at least that chapter, at the trademark level, they decided that the marks were confusing. Is that right?
That's right. The marks are very similar in sound and appearance. You know, they're just a couple letters difference, and they sound alike. And the board took some evidence on whether the goods on which the marks were going to be used were sufficiently different to dispel any likelihood of confusion, and it concluded that they weren't sufficiently different. The board said that we recognize that the fastener industry is not monolithic, but there are distinctions between construction fasteners and aerospace fasteners, but ultimately it thought that, you know, weighing all of those things, there was a likelihood of confusion here, and that is why B&B's registration of its mark prevented Hargis from registering its mark.
So tell us,
Hargis didn't feel that.
Tell us then, what happened in the infringement case where B&B sued Hargis for infringement?
So the infringement case was actually the second of two infringement cases, but you know it was on hold for a bit while matters went forward before the trademark board. But eventually, you know, B&B sought damages and an injunction against Hargis for its actual use in commerce of the infringing mark. And before the case went to trial, B&B sought summary judgment and said, we are, one element of our infringement case is likelihood of confusion. That's really the only disputed element here. Everyone agrees that the other elements are met. So you should grant us summary judgment on infringement, because the trademark board, in a dispute between the same two companies involving the same marks and the same fasteners, decided that there was a likelihood of confusion. And the district court, this is the Eastern District of Arkansas, decided, no, I'm not going to give preclusive effect to the board's judgment because the board is not a court. You know, as simple as that. The board is not an Article III court, and so I don't have to give preclusive effect to its judgment. And I'm also not going to let the jury hear about what the board decided. I'm going to instruct the jury that the board's decision does not concern it and doesn't go to the same issues. So the parties tried to the jury the same likelihood of confusion question that they had tried to the trademark board, and Hargis prevailed in the jury trial.
And then this case percolates its way up to the Supreme Court, and what did the Supreme Court decide?
It went to the Eighth Circuit, and the Eighth Circuit decided that preclusion was not warranted for a different reason than the district court had said. The Eighth Circuit didn't say agencies can never preclude courts. It decided that the issues really were different before the trademark board and the court. And its reasoning was a little opaque, but you know, it seemed basically to be saying the issues are different in registration than they are in infringement. You know, they both say likelihood of confusion, but the analysis for one is different from the analysis for the other. And it pointed, for example, to the fact that the board uses one set of factors and the Eighth Circuit uses a different set of factors. So the different circuits, and including the Federal Circuit, which reviews the trademark board, had decided these issues of preclusion differently. There were some circuits that said never, never, never preclusion, some circuits that said sometimes, and they differed on when the sometimes might be. And so B&B filed a petition for cert, and this is the point at which I got involved in the case, and asked the Supreme Court to resolve that conflict about when preclusion is appropriate.
And the bottom line from the Supreme Court was?
The bottom line was that likelihood of confusion means the same thing before the trademark board as it does before the district court as a legal matter. And so if the facts are the same, meaning you're litigating the same usages, you know, the same marks on the same goods or things that are so similar as to make no material difference, then it is appropriate to give preclusive effect to the first decision. Now, that can run in either direction. Sometimes the district court decides the issue first, and the trademark board has proceedings on hold waiting for the district court to decide them. Well, the district court's decision can be preclusive as well. But the first tribunal to decide these issues should get preclusive effect, again, if the issues really are the same. And the court acknowledged that oftentimes, you know, maybe in the large majority of cases, there will be differences in the issues. That might be because your registration in the Patent and Trademark Office looks different than the goods you actually start using. You know, your registration might say pants, but you might not actually be using your mark on the full range of pants out there in the real world. It might just be on, you know, khakis or jeans or, you know, capri pants. And those kinds of differences in the real world could make a difference to preclusion as well. But where there really is no difference in the facts, there is no reason not to apply preclusion, the court said.
What was the focus of the questions that you got from the bench at the hearing at the Supreme Court?
One thing that was interesting about the oral argument was the number of questions for me and for my opposing counsel and for the counsel for the federal government about what exactly it is that the trademark board decides when it decides cases. Hmm. What does it consider? What does it by rule not consider? What does it sometimes consider and sometimes not? And we had some disagreement at the lectern about whether, for example, the trademark board would look at market context, whether the trademark board would look at things like trade dress that go to what the mark looks like beyond the kind of font and color that the board takes off the table when you seek to register just a plain word mark. And there certainly are cases in which the board has found no likelihood of confusion, even though the marks are virtually identical because of other distinguishing features. And there are certainly are cases where the board has found a likelihood of confusion, even though the marks are somewhat different, because the accompanying features are quite similar. So it all depends, I think, on what the board is presented with in particular cases and what the boundaries of the registration submitted to the board are. But if you ask the board to look at a broader array of things, for the most part, the board will look at them, one categorical exception being geography. The board will not entertain an argument in a registration proceeding that I sell in Maine and you sell in Arizona and our goods are never likely to come into contact with each other, just because when you get a registration from the Patent and Trademark Office, it's good nationwide. And so they presume that you are going to come into contact with each other. That may never happen in infringement litigation or in actual use, I should say, in the actual use that is at issue in infringement litigation. And so if goods never come into contact with each other in the real world, the real market, then the fact that the board found a likelihood of confusion may not wind up mattering.
Okay, let's come back to a little bit deeper analysis of the confusion conclusion in a moment. But I guess one of the points the Supreme Court made, as I understand it, is that decisions from agencies such as the TTAB can form the basis for issue preclusion. There's nothing wrong with decisions made from there or second class in any way. Is that right?
That's right. The board, the court had decided a number of years ago, a decision that gave preclusive effect to an agency tribunal, and it had elaborated on that a little more about 20 years ago in a discrimination case, that it has a presumption that agency adjudications should get the same preclusive effect as they would if they'd been handed down by a court. Now, agency adjudications meaning disputes between two parties, not the kind of ex parte dispute between one litigant and the government that you sometimes see. This is a case in which they applied that presumption, and they said, we see nothing in the Lanham Act, the trademark statute, that tells the courts not to give preclusive effect to the trademark board's decisions. And so where the requirements of issue preclusion are met, we're going to go ahead and apply it.
I understand one of the arguments raised was that because in the United States you have a constitutional right to a jury trial, that didn't mean that the board decision should not be followed. Is that right?
Now, the court does not squarely resolve the constitutional objections. They kind of reserve them for another day, but they say that at a minimum, they're not so worried about the constitutional issue that they're going to read the statute in the way that Hargis wanted. So Hargis had said, before the trademark board, we don't get a jury, and we don't get an Article III judge, you know, a federal judge appointed by the Senate, confirmed by the president, confirmed by the Senate, life tenure, salary protection. And all of those reasons are reasons not to give preclusive effect to the board's decision in a court proceeding where we do have a right to a jury trial and where we do have a right to an Article III judge. And the court was not willing to read the Lanham Act Hargis's way for the sake of avoiding such a constitutional question. But it did drop, you know, a short statement saying that it was not definitively resolving those constitutional objections today. So I suppose that in another case where a litigant had really properly preserved them, maybe the court would be willing to reexamine it. Justice Thomas, and we can come back to this, you know, Justice Thomas was much more skeptical of agency adjudication, and he wrote the dissenting opinion. But the seven-justice majority was not.
Now, Hargis argued that there are different statutory requirements for registrability and infringement, and sometimes different factors considered. But what did the court have to say was the real issue involved at both instances?
So the issue in the statute is likelihood of confusion, or as the statute says, likely to cause confusion or to cause mistake or to deceive. And the same language appears in the registration provision as a ground for denying registration and in the infringement provision as a basis for, you know, an element that you have to show in order to prove infringement. And that's a concept that has been in the trademark law, lowercase T and L, much longer than the Lanham Act has been around. And effectively, the Lanham Act codified that concept in both places. So those are reasons to think that Congress wanted them to be the same concept. Now, every circuit has its own set of factors that it uses to decide these issues, and they are complicated issues that require you to balance a lot of factors. And the factors have different names and to some degree different content, but those factors are really just guides. The core issue is the same thing. And when the first tribunal decides it, it's binding on the second tribunal for that reason, if the other requirements of issue preclusion are met.
So you mentioned earlier that the preclusion may arise when the questions are the same, but sometimes the questions are different. When you're in an opposition circumstance, I think Justice Ginsburg described the comparison as sometimes being done, quote, in the abstract, end quote, as opposed to the actual usage in the marketplace. Can you talk a little bit about how the court handled those two different types of viewpoints of the usage?
I think the court's answer was basically things are not always going to be the same, but when they are the same, issue preclusion should apply. It's certainly correct that the board considers registration based on the registration papers that are submitted. And the registration papers that are submitted include, it can include the mark just as a word, you know, in which case color and font don't matter. You're getting a registration that allows you to use that word mark in any color and any font. But in infringement litigation, you have to prove an actual likelihood of confusion based on the use in real life. So that's one potential difference. But, you know, this was a case in which no one was having a fight about whether the marks looked sufficiently different in real life, whereas in the registrations, they look very much the same. This was a fight about the markets. And sometimes there are going to be differences between the markets recited in the registration applications, you know, which can be somewhat fictitious. You don't have to actually be marketing your good to file a registration application. You can simply say, I intend to use it on goods in the following markets. You know, I intend to use it on jeans and hats and camping gear and shoes. In infringement litigation, by contrast, you have to actually prove what you're doing, you know, actual use in commerce. So there can be differences there. But where there is no difference, that's when preclusion is appropriate.
I understand in looking at issue preclusion, if there has been a question as to the, and I'll quote from the decision, the quality, extensiveness, or fairness of the procedures followed in the prior litigation, you don't necessarily have issue preclusion. Does that, the fact that they followed the TTAB decision in this particular case, does that give sort of a good housekeeping seal of approval to the TTAB in terms of its quality, extensiveness, or fairness?
I do think that the Supreme Court did not credit the arguments made by some of the amici and to some degree by Hargis that the TTAB is either a kangaroo court or a low rent court to put it pejoratively, that you don't get enough process to make its judgments reliable and entitled to preclusive effect. There certainly are tribunals that are specifically set up to be fast rather than accurate. Small claims court is sort of the canonical example in the law of preclusion. They generally have a cap on the amount of recovery that you can get. They're intended to be done fast, without lawyers, without discovery. And so nobody would want the judgment of a small claims court to be preclusive because then no one would be willing to litigate in small claims court. The trademark board, you know, really is a lot like a district court in terms of its procedures. It has adopted the federal rules of civil procedure almost entirely. There are a few differences, the most significant of which is that the board doesn't physically sit there to listen to the live testimony. You can take a testimonial deposition and cross-examine to your heart's content, then you submit that in writing to the three judges on the trademark board who hear your case and decide your case. But that's not different than some other agency adjudications, which the Supreme Court has indicated in the past are perfectly fair. Sometimes in the criminal context, you see an issue being decided by a district judge rather than the magistrate judge who heard the actual testimony. So the Supreme Court was not particularly impressed with the idea that the limits on what the trademark board does, no live testimony before the judges and some limits on discovery, especially e-discovery, but not dramatically different from what happens in district court. The Supreme Court was not impressed by the idea that it was so different from what happens in a district court that it should be treated more like a small claims court or another tribunal that isn't entitled to preclusive effect.
Now, the decision was 7-2 with Thomas and Scalia dissenting. What, if anything, can we learn from the dissenting opinions in this case?
The dissent was interesting because it picked up on something a bit different than the parties and amici had been arguing. Justice Thomas, as probably many of your listeners know, is often inclined to question precedent and to think about how he would do things if he were deciding them in the first instance. And he, in this case, took a critical look at the discrimination case I mentioned from 27 years ago, Astoria Savings and Loan versus Solomino, in which the court had said it presumes that agency adjudication should be preclusive. And Justice Thomas was not buying that presumption, either as a matter of precedent or as a matter of, you know, the law of judgments going back to the founding. And he pointed out that this is something that applying the law of judgments that was around at the time the federal courts were set up, you would not expect an agency decision to receive preclusive effect. While he didn't decide this definitively, he thinks that the better presumption is that Congress should have to say so explicitly before an agency adjudication could be given preclusive effect. And in some other contexts, litigants might be able to successfully make that argument. So if you have a matter before some other tribunal besides the trademark board governed by a different statute, it may make sense to preserve this argument for that context as opposed to this one. But Justice Thomas didn't buy the arguments that we've been discussing, you know, the idea that the Seventh Amendment rules out preclusion here, or that as a statutory matter the issues are different, or that the trademark board is procedurally deficient.
So then what's next for this case?
The Supreme Court did not definitively decide whether on the facts of this case the issues were the same in the trademark board and in the district court. It ordered a remand to the Eighth Circuit for that purpose, and the Supreme Court's judgment has not yet been formally issued, so nothing has happened on that yet, but those are the next steps.
In the broader context of trademark litigation, particularly TTAB cases, I have a sense that the bar must now have learned that these cases are not a dry run for infringement, and both sides better take the matter pretty seriously in the first instance. Can you sort of say what lessons should the practitioners take from this case?
I think that what you said is a fair statement, that the first case, which might be in district court or might be in the trademark board, should not be regarded as a dry run that can end with a do-over, except for this. Remember that if you litigate first in the trademark board and you don't like the outcome, you have a right of appeal, which is even more of a do-over than a regular appeal. You can go to a district court and do the case over again, putting in new evidence. And on the new evidence, the district judge will not have to defer to the trademark board's findings with regard to the old evidence. So you have a quite robust chance at a do-over if the first adjudication is in the trademark board, but you better use it, because if you don't use it, then the trademark board's decision may well be preclusive on future decisions that involve the same usages, same marks, same goods, or materially indistinguishable marks and goods.
Is there any fear that the appeal court might take the point of view that some do, which is, we'll let you put new evidence in, but it better be evidence that was otherwise not available to you in the first instance, or you better have a good excuse as to why you want it put in at this point? Is there any fear of that that arising in these circumstances?
You know, the Supreme Court in a case called Capos versus Hyatt involving the patent trial and appeal board, which previously went by another name, was asked to decide something very much like that, that the PTO should be entitled to great deference on things that were not, that the PTO should be entitled to great deference where the new evidence was not submitted to the PTO, so the PTO didn't get a chance to pronounce on it. And the court was, the Supreme Court was quite dismissive of that. You know, it said that Congress has given you this right to go to district court and to put in new evidence. And if that is to mean anything, it means that we will disregard what the Patent Trial and Appeal Board has decided where that's necessary to give full consideration to the new evidence. Some of these things may be relevant at the margin as the finder of fact kind of weighs the credibility of the new evidence. You know, so for example, if it looks like you manufactured it after you tried the case in the trademark board or the patent board, then that certainly may detract from its credibility. But it doesn't give the board's decision any extra weight that you came up with the evidence later.
And I suppose at least we've seen it in Canadian courts where the appeal court or judge might say, well, this just seems to be more of the same. It's not material in the sense that it changes things. Therefore, I'll follow the decision made in the trademarks office.
That could be. I mean, it's up to individual judges how much evidence to permit as a matter of judicial administration. But you know, there is a right to have essentially a do-over. And if a judge were extremely stingy about that, I think the judge would be liable to being reversed by the Court of Appeals.
What's the effect of this decision on patent cases that are being decided before the USPTO?
I think a lot of people are focused on that as one of the key unanswered questions of the Supreme Court's decision. I'll make a couple of observations about that. One is that the presumption would ordinarily apply to the Patent Trial and Appeal Board just the same. In other words, the presumption that because it's doing adjudication, it ought to be given preclusive effect unless Congress provides otherwise. But with respect to the inter partes reviews and other inter partes proceedings set up by the 2011 America Invents Act, there is a provision in the statute that deals with what I think the statute calls estoppel, but we know which basically is a claim preclusion rule that says if you litigate issues before the patent board, you cannot relitigate those issues or other issues that you could have but did not litigate before the patent board elsewhere. And the fact that Congress took the trouble to write a rule of preclusion may well discourage courts from applying sort of common law rules of preclusion in addition to those that Congress wrote. The second point is that one thing about issue preclusion is that ordinarily, for the issues to really be the same, the burdens are supposed to be the same too. That means that if case number one involves a plaintiff who has to show something by clear and convincing evidence, and case number two involves a lower burden, or I suppose even a higher burden, or if the burden's on the other party, you wouldn't apply preclusive effect to the first judgment because the plaintiff couldn't carry the high burden in case number one doesn't mean the plaintiff couldn't carry a lower burden in case number two. The patent board does not apply the same heightened burden to invalidity issues that the district courts do. And the patent board, for many, although not all cases, applies a different standard of patent claim construction than the district courts do. So that right there, under just issue preclusion doctrine generally, setting aside what the statute says, would presumably be a reason not to give preclusive effect to the patent board's decisions on those issues where the burdens are different.
Congratulations, Willie, on the win, and thank you very much for these insights.
Thank you very much for speaking with me today.
William Jay is a partner at Goodwin Proctor LLP in Washington, D.C. For further information on the B&B Hardware and Hargis decision, and for information on other jurisdiction podcasts, please visit iplawpodcast.com. You've been listening to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast. I'm Don Cameron of Breskin & Parr LLP in Toronto, Canada. Thank you for listening.